We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good evening. Welcome to Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm helping out while Steve is on a cross-country road trip for 3 weeks. He'll be back in about 2 weeks. And this evening on Keeping the Faith, we have a guest with us who is focused primarily in his interest on the issues associated with restorative justice. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. His name is Mikhail Lyubansky. Thank you for coming to the program.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Appreciate it. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yeah, Mikhail Lyubansky.
Mikhail. Okay. Thank you. Professor Lyubansky is managing editor of Op-Ed News. I take it that's still the case. Might tell us a little bit about that. He's a member of the teaching faculty in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois here in Champaign-Urbana. He teaches courses on the psychology of race and ethnicity and theories of psychotherapy, and his research and writing interests are focused on race relations, immigration, and the topic for today's program, restorative justice. There's so many other things that you've been involved in your publications. We don't really have time to discuss it, but why don't we just start with just a very basic description of what the concept of restorative justice is. I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of the idea. There are many systems and programs and models and theories, but you are involved in one in particular, but we'll talk about that in a few minutes. Just what in general is the concept of restorative justice?
Well, the concept of restorative justice is basically the idea that instead of using conventional approaches to justice, which prioritize figuring out who did something wrong and then punishing that person, restorative approaches try to meet the needs of all three parties in a conflict. They don't assign blame. They don't try to punish. They look at the needs of the so-called offender, the so-called victim, and the needs of the community. And I say so-called because the system that I work with doesn't like these terms, doesn't use these terms. I use them for the benefit of our listeners who are probably familiar with them. And the reason that we don't like those terms is because what role a person has in a conflict sometimes changes from moment to moment, from day to day, so that sometimes if two people are in a relationship, there is an act in which one person offends and the other one is victimized, and then there's a different occasion, a different act in which that is reversed. And so when we try to address that conflict, engage that conflict, realizing and coming into the conflict with the idea that that who the offender is and who the victim is flexible, is dynamic. And so we use a different vocabulary to try to capture that complexity.
Particularly when you bring in the community, there could be multiple players in the alleged conflict.
Sure. There are multiple players. So maybe I should mention what I mean by community. Mm. So I guess I'll introduce the vocabulary here. We use the vocabulary of author. The author is the person who did the act that somebody else experienced as painful. The receiver is the person that is the primary receiver of that act that the author did. And then the community, in this case, consists of individuals who are impacted by the conflict. And that community can be very small. We can talk about a family as a community where I have two kids and sometimes they fight each other with each other. And my wife and I are impacted by that conflict. If my wife and I fight, our kids are impacted by that conflict. And sometimes the community can be quite large in the Champaign-Urbana community. The Kiwan Carrington situation is obviously impacting the entire community. And so it's a very big group.
About 2 or 3 weeks ago, you wrote an op-ed piece in the News Gazette in which you mentioned the Juwan Carrington issue as the latest and most difficult one, but there are so many others. I understand that you prefer not to use words like perpetrator, offender. You mentioned the word author. I assume that's the preferred language in the system.
In this particular system that I'm trained in, and that I'm sharing at the moment, that's the vocabulary that's used. There are many other restorative systems, and most of them rely on the language that's familiar to most listeners: offender and victim.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. This is a call-in show, and if you're interested in this topic and you'd like to talk with Professor Mikhail Lyubansky, who is with us today to talk about his current interest in restorative justice, you can call in locally. The number is 333-9455. There's also an 800 number if you'd like to call, 1-800-222-9455. Your interest in this came about at what point in your life? I think I remember reading something about you. In fact, you mentioned this in this op-ed piece and a couple of articles on your website. Not too many years ago, you were focused primarily on justice as equality, and you have come to a change in your thinking about this. How did you arrive at this? And just describe a little bit about how your journey proceeded.
Up to now, I've really been focusing on racial issues and racial justice, and really thinking about racial justice as something that that what racial justice looks like is inequality of opportunity, and an equitable sort of distribution in terms of education, employment opportunities, incarceration rates. So looking at the racial gaps that exist in a variety of these different domains, and really being concerned about how to eliminate them or at least narrow them. And it's through this work that I came to the restorative work, because I was looking for a specific way for a community to engage in a racial healing process. The Kellogg Foundation put out a call for grant proposals, and so I was wanting to write a grant proposal working with the Center for Democracy and a Multicultural Society, mm-hmm. Multiracial Society, excuse me, here on campus. And I was looking for a specific process through which a community could engage in racial healing. And talking to people about, what has been done in other places, what might work. And every so often, I'd get the name Dominic Barter. You really should talk to Dominic. And I'd say, well, great. Where's Dominic? How do I get in touch with him? And I'd hear, well,
why did his name keep popping up?
Just that he, as I described what it was that I was looking for, a way for a whole community to engage in healing. And so what people were hearing is a more sort of compassionate approach that focused on connection and relationship building rather than on structural and systemic change, which is also mm-hmm. important, but something that's a little bit different. And so his name kept coming up, and I said, well, great, how do I talk to him? And people said, well, he's in Brazil. And I said, oh, well, I guess I'll have to keep looking, because I just didn't think that anybody in Brazil was accessible to me in any kind of meaningful way. But eventually, when his name came up enough, it came up in the context of him visiting, doing a training in Oakland, California. And this was actually about a year ago. And so I decided, not quite on a whim, but just to go. I didn't really know exactly what to expect. And I got on a plane and went to his workshop. And 15 minutes in, this was 5 days that I was planning to spend there. 15 minutes in, I knew that this was the way I wanted to. This was going to be the focus of my work for the next indefinite future.
Really?
Yeah, 15 minutes.
So it was very impactful for you.
It was immediately impactful.
Mm-hmm. You told me a story about having gotten the training in an airport. You got a call from your wife. You want to tell that story?
Yeah. So my partner is the director of the Psychological Services Center on campus, which is the training clinic for the psychology department, where our graduate students learn how to provide psychotherapy and community psychology services. And they provide those services to the community, to the larger community, on a sliding scale fee, kind of the way cooking schools and barber schools train their students. And so I'm in the airport, and I get a call from my wife, and she says, I got a call today from a church, and they are looking for somebody to do a circle. And she said, a week ago I wouldn't have been able to help them, but now, is this something you want to do? And I said, sure. So I got off the plane and had to set some things up, but I did a circle, a restorative circle for the church a week later.
So within a matter of a week, you became the local guru for restorative justice.
No, I'm working on it.
Yeah, right. It's interesting that someone prior to your having received training had heard about restorative circles, right? So they knew about the program?
Well, not here. I was trying to talk to people I knew in the nonviolent communication community, the NVC community, and people I knew through various social media networks, mm-hmm. who were engaged in racial justice work. So, I mean, another person that was coming up in that context was Lee Moon-hwa. Lee Moon-hwa, he's a filmmaker of Chinese descent who made a wonderful film in, I think it was 1989, called The Color of Fear.
Oh, yes.
And he's continuing to do that kind of work in communities all over the country.
Now, you mentioned that there are many different programs and systems, and you've mentioned the Center for Nonviolent Communication and Dominic Barter. What are some of the differences, and how did you gravitate towards Barter as opposed to some of these others?
It wasn't really a conscious choice of looking at the different systems and deciding, well, this is the one that I'm interested in. I got pulled into Dominic Barter's work in the way that I described. Mm-hmm. And then once I started to learn about restorative practices from him, then of course I became more interested in the larger movement and started to look into what are some of the other things that other restorative systems are doing, both locally and nationwide. So I have a sense of the differences and in retrospect, have a very firm commitment to the particular system that I'm trained in.
And why do you like it over others?
For a couple of reasons. One is that it's deliberately not professionalized. Mm. So rather than having professional mediators, circle keepers, people who have a lot of training, who usually work for a fee, who come in and coordinate the process, the restorative circle process is community owned, and again, the community is defined by itself. So, a family is a community. A classroom in a school can be a community. The school itself can be a community. A church is a community. Any group of people that feels connected to one another, that decides that it wants to have some way of engaging conflict when conflict occurs, and it occurs, is a community. And so this is a way for a community to decide that this is how we want to do justice, do conflict. And within a short amount of time, a few days, those members of the community who are interested in learning how to facilitate, there's a little bit of training involved. They can get that training and they can facilitate conflict within their own community.
How long does it take to do the training?
3 days minimum, 9 days ideally.
Are you thinking about setting up a training program here?
I'd love to. Mm-hmm. But when you say training program, I guess I want to change that to what I'm really interested in is working with...
That language suggests experts with white coats.
Yeah, it does. So what I really want to do is work with specific community groups, again, anything from a classroom to larger communities, and help, and train. I mean, there is some training involved. Train members of that community to facilitate conflict.
There is something top-down about the idea of an expert with a suit on that comes in to help. And you're trying to move away from... Barter obviously moves away from that. As you mentioned to me, he resists institutionalizing the program and the process and tries to, if I understand you correctly, or him, to grow it up from where the conflict occurs.
Yeah, he'd like to see lots of little restorative systems rather than a few big ones, mm-hmm. which is sort of counterintuitive. Most of us who are interested and have a commitment to something want to see it grow as big as possible.
Right.
And so this is he doesn't. So, you know, lots of small systems that don't have a lot of institutional necessarily power.
Now, why is there... Clearly, there's a widespread dissatisfaction throughout the country, and I think definitely here in Champaign-Urbana, particularly Champaign, largely because of the case that you mentioned, such a growing dissatisfaction with our present adversarial justice system. What's the problem?
Well, I think it has a lot of problems, but you're right. There's a lot of discontent with it. In surveys of people who go through that system, and in this statistic I include those that we would call offenders and those that we would call victims, the overall satisfaction rate with the process tends to be under 20%. And then this is in contrast with people who go through restorative systems as an alternative.
Now, these are actual research surveys of people who've been involved?
These are
all
yes.
stakeholders in the system on both sides?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. So these numbers that I'm giving you now are coming from Brazil, where this process is grown.
But I'm just getting ready to say prosecutors who get elected on cases that they win obviously are happy with the system, right?
You know, I'm sure we can find champions of the current system who say this is it. This is about as well as we can do conflict. This is about as well as we can do justice. But my sense is if you get people in a honest conversation, judges, lawyers, anybody involved will tell you that the system is flawed.
Frustrated with
it. Yeah, with different aspects of it. Prison guards, report some of the highest rates of dissatisfaction.
Really?
Yeah, it's a hard job.
Mm-hmm. To bring our listeners up to speed, we're talking to Professor Mikhail Lyubianskiy, who is professor of psychology at the University of Illinois. His topic with us today is restorative justice. I'm not sure you want to say it as an alternative to the existing system of justice in the United States or other ways of thinking in adversarial ways, but we can talk more about in what sense it's a new approach. And if you're interested in talking to Professor Lyubianskiy, you can call in at 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. Well, let's talk just a little bit more about the dissatisfaction. You mentioned prison guards, lawyers on both sides of a case. Why are citizens in general who don't necessarily have that much involvement with the justice system feel disconnected with it? There seems to be this widespread cynicism. I often get into conversations with people about the justice system, and the term in philosophical circles that I run in is that we have here in the United States a system of rough justice. And I'm not even sure that's true anymore. The cynicism seems to be widespread even beyond those who have gotten caught up into the system. What's going on?
Well, one of the things that's going on is that our incarceration rates, our prison population has increased, I think, roughly 400% since 1980. Mm-hmm. And so much of it was coming from the Reagan administration and the new, at the time, war on drugs. And so much of the increase is a result of that war on drugs. So much of it is drug-related crime.
Don't we have the largest prison population in any Western industrialized country?
We do, as far as I know. I don't track those statistics really carefully. So part of the dissatisfaction is that we incarcerate so many people, and we want to connect that to safety. We want the justice system, part of the needs that we have from a justice system is to keep us safe. Well, that incarceration rate has been climbing at the rate I just described, even as violent crime has been decreasing during that same time period.
Mm-hmm.
You could argue, well, the reason that violent crime has been decreasing is because we're locking so many people up. but it hasn't played out quite like that. So that, you know, when you look at specific time periods when crime rate goes down, and you know, looking at incarceration rates, they don't much correlate. People's sense of safety. If we ask people, as researchers have done, how safe do you feel in your community? And we can ask that question in lots of complicated ways. But you know, generally, how safe do you feel? That sense of safety has remained entirely stable over the same period of time. We don't feel any safer,
which is not a good thing that it's been stable. It's the lack of feeling of safety has been stable.
Yeah, yeah. So part of the dissatisfaction is a recognition that we're locking more and more people up. It's not increasing our sense of safety, and it's you know, the other part is that we're very disconnected from the process as citizens. So if there are justice concerns, you know, the court deals with them and the court administers sort of justice. But there's not really a way for the community to be involved in that process. And again, I want to step back from the large criminal justice system because it's harder for a lot of us to relate to, and step into a context you know, that we probably have more familiarity with. Step into a school system where, you know, because we've all been through schools, and the schools use exactly the same justice model as the criminal justice system. And so the kids that are in the school. And let's say there's a bully, or let's say there are two kids that are fighting with each other, and the teachers stop the fight, and there's some kind of process that then happens in which they decide who...
A scripted process.
They decide which of the kids, possibly both, is at fault, and then there's some kind of administration of punishment. Mm-hmm. A detention, a suspension. In the very early grades, when I went to an elementary school, junior high, there was a bench in the hallway outside the principal's office, and anybody who got in trouble in quotations, had to sit on that bench, kind of like in a stockade, and all the other kids who would be passing through the hall would know that this is a kid who got in trouble.
Modern version of the dunce cap.
Yeah. And so when I say, well, the community doesn't have any involvement in this, you know, what's the impact on the other kids in the school? What's the impact on the teachers? Are their lives going to be better as a result of this punishment? Did they have some kind of voice? Were their needs represented? Were their needs heard by the quote-unquote offender? No, somebody else is doing it. We've you know, sort of farmed out. You know, we hire people to mow our lawns, and we hire people to do our justice work for us.
So the range all the way from the justice system, I guess you could go, if the word hire is appropriate, to politics today, all the way from there to justice system, to schools, even to family and spousal relationships, these principles apply.
Sure, yeah. Right. The traditional way of, you know, wait till your father gets home, which is mm-hmm. probably not the way a lot of families handle conflict now. But the idea is the same. There's some kind of disciplinarian, some kind of authority person who gets to decide who's at fault, and what kind of punishment is necessary.
We have a caller on line one from Champaign. Good afternoon. You have a question or comment to put to Professor Lyubomsky.
Well, I'm trying to understand the restorative justice. I think I'm familiar with the, at least in the school models of say, 5 to 10 years ago. But in the community, and since you mentioned the tragedy of a year ago last October, I just want to give a different perspective here, and I think it's important to the whole idea of the holistic community. I live six houses away. That was my neighborhood that this very unfortunate series of events happened in, that ended up with a young man dying, which was very tragic. The thing that really bothers me, and I'm going to try to say this very carefully, there are certain groups who seem to politically exploit these issues, and I'm trying to be very careful here, or perhaps use them to meet political ends. However, there were three shootings in this neighborhood of North Champaign over the last 10 months. We had two drive-bys last summer, which were just kind of horrific. One of them up off of North Bradley, someone from out of town just basically came and sprayed bullets. But we've had two other gun incidents in town. There's so much violence in our schools, as someone who has worked in middle schools and grade schools as well. And the problem is, that I see it, is that everybody points to the authorities, and I'm not trying to blame here because I understand the effects of poverty and social injustice and this huge disparity in wages we have. But some of these groups do not rally when there's a shootout. They don't rally when there's a drive-by. They don't rally for all the events of violence. And that's what I think needs to happen. I think that as adults, we need to point to people, especially other adults, who are wearing T-shirts that say, "Don't be a snitch," and say, "You're destroying our community. Your tolerance of violence, your tolerance of people gaming the system and being violent and engaging in violent crime, whatever the cause is not helping." And so I think we need both. We need to address income disparity, which is huge. We need to face the fact that 75% of the recipients of Medicaid and food stamps in the U.S. are children. We need to address both issues. We need to address the adversarial nature of the police department, but the police department in Champaign has worked very hard. I've lived here since 1971, and I do remember what the police officers were like then. And I just feel it's going to take both sides. And the problem I have, and I think restorative justice does address this, is that frequently it's just pointing at the system and saying the system is bad, instead of getting the whole community involved and saying, why aren't you upset that these other things are happening? So this is very hard for me to talk about, and I'm sorry if I've been antagonistic, and I do feel restorative justice is part of this. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your very good comments, Professor Lubansky.
I agree with the caller. He would like to see all violence be taken equally seriously by various groups, and so would I. And I agree with him that restorative practices fit well with the kind of world that he wants to see. And so part of the appeal of restorative practices for me is that they do involve all three parties to the conflict, not just the quote-unquote offender and the victim, but also the community members. So this is a way for the community to be involved and in a process designed to accomplish mutual understanding and personal responsibility and an action plan in which there's some kind of restorative act or acts done, that the community is involved in that process rather than farming it out and hiring somebody else to do it for them. They're involved. They talk about their needs, what they want to see in a way, and their needs are given as much weight, as much attention, as much worth as the needs of the quote-unquote victim and the quote-unquote perpetrator.
We do tend to balkanize our institutions, don't we? If an offense occurs in a community, the caller mentioned earlier that nobody rose up to respond. I don't know what reasons there are for why that happened, but frequently we assume that, well, there's a system out there that'll take care of that problem, and then we don't think about it anymore. They just get lost in that blob over there. And in a way, that's our responsibility for not getting involved. As what's the old saw that my grandmother used to do? You point a finger and you get three fingers pointing back at you. Our community, our system, we have created, we're involved in it. It's ours. We pay the taxes. And what you're essentially saying, and Dominique Barter and others, is let's take wider, broader, deeper responsibility for these problems as a community, as individuals in a network of relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the same, just like we do that in the family and in a classroom. So we can do it in slightly different ways. You know, the process requires some flexibility, but conflict is conflict, from criminal conflict to sibling conflict. The way that we can engage with it can be restorative.
Now, you mentioned school boards and school systems being caught up in this adversarial system where you have to find who the offender is and who the victim is and who's the one that who's the bad guy, as we tend to say. I served on a local school board and certainly remember sitting in dozens and dozens of hearings where a young offender is sitting on the other side of the table from the board who is acting as judge and jury. And they typically or often will have a lawyer or someone speaking for them. If you're in a situation like that, how do you break that open and suggest to, say, fellow school board members who have the power not to throw this child into the jaws of the justice system out there and say, well, let's listen at another level? I once suggested that. I remember in a particularly excruciating case, and the response I got back, particularly from a couple of more conservative members, was, you know, if you respond that way, you're just going to reinforce other people to feel like they can take advantage of the system. And you, I think the word weak was used. Mm-hmm. How do you break the mentality at, let's say, a school board level to get people to think more deeply, more broadly about these kinds of conflicts? Let's say on a you know that a hearing is coming up and there are ways to avoid it. What might you do?
Well, you have some conversations, and ideally they would happen before, you know, the earlier in the process as possible, because by the time their hearing's scheduled, there are already lawyers involved. There are already the gears are already grinding in the current system. So you want to set it up earlier.
In the schools,
so that there's already an alternative, because it's really hard to stop a mechanism that's already
in
motion.
Once the lawyers are involved, they're in the...
Yeah. So you started earlier, I mean, or you started then and hope that, you know, it gets set up before the next, you know, the next situation. But there's probably the biggest misconception about restorative principles that I hear about is that it doesn't have accountability. There's a concern that that we're letting the kids in this case or adults or whoever is involved, that we're letting them off the hook somehow, that we're not holding them accountable. And that's not how a restorative system is set up. A restorative system is set up to do three things. One is to have all parties really understand each other the way that each party wants to be understood. The next thing is for people to take responsibility for their action. And it's personal responsibility taking. It's part of the process, which a person can only do after hearing and really understanding what the specific act meant and how it impacted people. So part of what a restorative circle does is it lets everybody involved see the impact of what they did on everyone else. And from that comes a sense of, okay, now that I see what I did, and that, by the way, is for the receivers and the community members too. Because the other role of community members, in addition to being impacted by the conflict, in many cases, they've also had something to do with creating the kind of system and structure that allowed the conflict to take place in the first place.
So just listening is not enough. You need to go beyond that to find out what created the conditions for this conflict to take place.
That's what everybody contributed. Everybody in the circle, which again, the author, receiver, and the people impacted by the conflict.
That's often difficult, I think, for deans of students in schools to do. It's been my experience. They often feel that they have to show that they're strong and sticking to the policy, and this is what the language said, and this is what the kid did.
Yeah. So this is the way that power is used in systems. So there are a couple different ways, and so there are, most of the way that we typically handle conflict is we use power over. Whoever has power uses it to keep other people in place and accountable, et cetera. we can have an absence of power in which there's more or less anarchy and people can sort of come and go and as they want and do as they please and there's no accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And the restorative practice involves power with. There's power involved. There are the authority people are involved. The informal power holders in a school, you know, the kids are involved.
Well, tell us a little bit about how, if a school was interested in pursuing this, how would we go about setting up a way of anticipating these problems? You talk about a training program. Let's say, let's not pick it on any particular school, but let's just call it John Hope Franklin School for middle school for whatever. If they're impressed with what you're describing and they would like to anticipate inevitable conflicts in a given day in a typical middle school on a public school system, and they called you up, what would you say to these folks?
I'd say that, you know, what's interesting about, I said this is an non-professionalized mm-hmm. sort of process. And so the what may not be obvious is in a school system, the people that I'd like to see facilitating the conflicts are the kids. I'd like to see them facilitating their own conflict.
You do mention that in your op-ed piece in the News Gazette that sometimes the best facilitators are 10-year-olds.
Yeah, the power in the restorative process lies in the process and not in the facilitation.
Mm-hmm.
So the facilitator just creates the space and asks some questions, but everything that's wonderful and powerful happens because the process allows it to happen.
So it would be triggered by an event, or would you have a principal and teachers go through this training program? How do you avoid institutionalizing it without a particular event taking place? What would you do? What would you say to the people asking you to start the program?
Well, we'd need to find some ways for those who are interested to get some training. And I'd love for teachers to get trained. I'd love for the administration to get trained. I'd love for kids to get trained. And then how the actual specific restorative circle is activated, that would be something that the kids and the teacher and the administration would decide together. You know, some kind of box in a central location that somebody would check regularly. And it probably depends a little bit on the conflict. The other thing is anybody can initiate it. So I talked about three parties to the conflict. The receiver, the author, the community member, anybody can initiate a restorative process.
Mm-hmm.
And then they name the people that they think need to be at the circle in order to engage with the conflict.
I'm just thinking back in the days when I was on a school board as a policymaker, you'd need some sort of menu for these overworked and beleaguered administrators, do this and then do this and then do this. At some point, they would need, I would think, a trigger to say, here is a terrible conflict. It's going to blow up in my face and make the headlines tomorrow. What do I do? If there's a legitimate policy option that they can push this button and go to a restorative systems approach with training that we've already received, that would be ideal. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be ideal. Having a space in the school that was dedicated to this process that can be used when there was a need to have a restorative circle that everybody recognized was used for that space, you know, that would be required. But again, it doesn't need. This is not necessarily something that is going to stand in the place of, however, the school has been used to solving conflict.
Correct.
It's a system that is going to be put in place in addition to, that can be activated by the kids, by the teachers, by the principal, by anybody who wants to activate it.
Right. You're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, but giving more options.
That's right.
We have a caller on line 4. Sorry to keep you waiting. From Champaign, you have a question or comment for our guest.
Yes. Very interesting program, and I really appreciate your efforts. I guess I was thinking about if and when you do get involved in the courts and a person has been shown to be guilty and you're trying to work at the relationship between the the two parties. What is it? Is what kind of sentence happens? Is it a combination of community service, maybe some jail, and then some probation, or what generally happens in terms of sentencing?
Thank you, caller. So in a criminal case, so when I hear a guilty verdict, I'm assuming it's a criminal case, a restorative process can be initiated at any point, either before the criminal proceedings, during or after the criminal proceedings. And in some cases, and this would obviously require the cooperation of the judge and lawyers involved, in some cases, the restorative process can stand in place of the criminal process.
Does that happen often?
It depends where. So this is still relatively new to the United States. In Brazil, where this particular process was developed, especially in youth cases, there are 8 court systems in Brazil and hundreds of schools that have instituted restorative practices. And so what the courts will do, the judges will refer cases directly to a restorative system. The restorative process will take place there, and then whatever came out of that restorative process will come back to the judge, and the lawyers will make sure that everything is legal, and they'll sign off, and that'll be that.
In those cases, is a person often – I realize it depends on the case by case, but a lot of times is jail avoided, or are they combinations of jail and a number of other things that are involved?
So if the restorative process is taking the place of the criminal process, then usually there will not be jail time because jail is basically a punishment. That doesn't mean that there's no accountability. That doesn't mean there's no responsibility taking. The person who authored the act that hurt another person may be asked to do quite a bit of restitution and may voluntarily choose to do quite a bit of restitution, but there wouldn't be a jail sentence.
And that restitution would be something like court-ordered? I mean, he'd have to fulfill it in order to stay clean in the eyes of the court?
In Brazil, as I understand it, so part of it, what makes a restorative system effective? Part of it is it's effective because it's voluntary. So people are much more likely to do what they say they're going to do if they're making the choice of their free will to do it, as opposed to being forced by an authority person to do it.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your call. Just a couple of announcements before we go on. Support for Keeping the Faith has been provided in part from listeners like you who contribute to WLL, from the Friends Meeting on East Main in Urbana, and from the University YMCA in Champaign. And the YMCA in particular has a series of lectures that are ongoing throughout the year. There is the Friday Forum, which is a lecture series. The theme is Deconstructing the American Dream. It's held weekly from noon to 1:30 in Latzer Hall at the University of YMCA. All lectures are free and open to the public, and you can purchase lunch there for around $6, $3 if you're a student. On October 22nd this week, the lecture is by Mr. Brian Gaines, Professor, Department of Political Science and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, who will be talking about tea parties, political parties, and predictions for the 2010 midterm elections. There's also a Know Your University series every Tuesday at 12 noon at the University YMCA. On October 19th, the topic will be Building a Native-Centered Learning Community. Irvin Harrison, who is director of Native American House, will be giving that lecture. And then on October 26th, the topic will be Humanities on Campus by Nancy Abelman, who is Associate Vice Chancellor, Research for the Humanities, Arts, and Related Fields, as well as Diane Harris, who is the Director of Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. So thank you for those who have supported this program. We are talking with Professor Mikhail Lyubansky on the topic of restorative justice. Can you summarize a little bit more precisely if someone asks you, what are the basic principles of the particular system that you are attracted to? How would you summarize the principles and the role that they play in an actual setting?
I would say that the main principles that are appealing to me, one is power sharing, power with. So again, involving everybody involved in the conflict, from the author, receiver, and the community, in the mutual understanding process, in the responsibility taking process, and in the action planning process. So it's not, you know, the other thing I want to say is, it doesn't stop with understanding. That's clearly one of the goals of the process. But at the end, after we have understanding, what ideally will happen, what the process is designed to facilitate happening, is that people volunteer to do things to restore the conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a story, and
Concrete actions that people would
these
perform.
Are concrete actions, and I want to make the point here that there's a differentiation made between restorative acts and reparative acts. So it's called restorative justice, but there is a difference between those two terms. And usually we think of reparative acts as the acts that sort of, you know, address the conflict. Reparative acts are those that fix, undo, make better whatever was harmed originally. So if I break somebody's window, the reparative act would be for me to repair the window, mm-hmm. either physically repaired or pay for somebody else to repair it, or
to mow their lawn for the next 6 weeks or whatever.
Exactly. So that's a reparative act. A restorative act is an act that doesn't do that, but has some kind of symbolic value in terms of restoring the relationship. So the most typical restorative act that we all know is an apology. The words don't have, they can't fix the window. But if I broke your window and your sense is that I really do regret it and you feel that my apology is genuine, that may be enough to restore relationships. Mm-hmm. In fact, people like both. People who've been harmed like to get both restorative and reparative acts, and then they often feel satisfied. But if they only can have one, it turns out that people prefer restorative acts mm-hmm. over reparative ones. And I'll give you an example that Dominic tells. Do we have time for an example?
Just very briefly.
Sure.
We've just got about 10 minutes left. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment to Professor Liobonsky on our topic today on restorative justice, you can call in at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. So you're about to give us an example. What was it?
Yeah, this is Dominic's story, and I enjoyed listening.
Dominic Barter, who is the – how would you describe him?
Dominic created this particular restorative process.
Okay.
He's his formal educational background is in social work, but he doesn't practice traditional social work. He's created this restorative system in Brazil. So he tells a story of two people in Brazil, and one of them, his job required the people to deliver, transport various supplies. It wasn't a high-paying job, but he needed the car to do it. And one day, there's a car accident, and another person clearly, if we were in the business of assigning blame, we'd assign it to this other person who smashed into his car and wrecked it beyond repair. And a restorative process was instituted, and mutual understanding, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm going to jump ahead into the last phase. The person who crashed into his car didn't have the money to repair it, didn't have the money to purchase a new one, didn't have the money to provide or a car to really provide the receiver with any kind of reparative act. He had $10, and he said, "I will give you this $10." And the receiver found that acceptable. And the reason he found it acceptable was because he said, "You crashed into my car. You took away everything I had. I can't do anything anymore. I can't work. And in return, you gave me everything you had." and that works for me. Now, there are community members involved, community members who knew both parties.
Right.
And so the accountability is there's no deception involved. It's not the case that that this person had, you know, $1,000 in his bank account and was just offering 10.
So it was evident that he was being genuine in giving all that he had.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that was a restorative act, mm-hmm. and the two men were okay.
Now, you say that stakeholders share responsibilities for restorative justice. In that particular example, a stakeholder would be the person who had the damage done to him or her. What role or responsibility would they have in that situation? To just simply respond and say, this is enough? Or what do you mean by saying that they have a responsibility?
Yeah. I mean, so they have a responsibility to put their needs on the table and to sort of represent their needs and interests.
By coming to this negotiation or conversation, that's they're fulfilling their responsibility to participate in a restorative process.
They may have something to offer. So I'll tell another story also from Brazil. Eventually, I'll tell American stories. So in this case, the receiver is a person working. I'll keep it short. Is a person working in a 7-Eleven type of convenience store in behind the cash register, and one day he's robbed at gunpoint, and the young man is wearing a mask. He comes in with a gun, takes money, leaves. The police catch him, and again, because there is a restorative system in this community, that system is activated, and there is a restorative circle called in which everybody's at the table. During the mutual understanding part of the process, several things emerge. One, the cashier reveals that he had a chance to kill the author. He had that chance because during the course of the robbery, the author put his gun down on the counter while he was doing something else, and the receiver had the chance to grab the gun and use it and chose not to. Mm-hmm. Another thing that was revealed, this by the author, is that he didn't want to do the act, that he was basically caught by a group of kids, and this was part of a gang initiation thing, and was basically given the gun and told that he had to do it or they would hurt him. Mm-hmm. And so he, again, didn't, you know, that he wasn't really, this wasn't something that he wanted to do. And that by the time that this mutual understanding is taking place, the person working, the cashier, who actually owned the little 7-Eleven, was so invested in the young man who robbed him that he offered him a job, okay, and which was accepted. And part of it was recognition that he recognized that he would be safer working with him than if he was out in the street. And so that's another.
Requires a degree of humanity in that person, too, coming to the table.
I love that term because that's what a restorative system does. It rehumanizes all the participants, because often we get so upset that we're seeing the enemy, we're seeing the other person as an enemy, as something that's a little bit different than human.
Right. We have a caller from all the way from Indianapolis on line 4. Hello, you're on Keeping the Faith. Question or comment for Professor Lyubomsky? Are you there?
Yes, hello.
Thank you.
My question or comment, I guess, is I'm really confused about this whole thing. I understand, like, you keep relating back to, like, school. But I think normal society is a lot different than school, because you're not talking about, like, stealing somebody's eraser. You're talking about big things, and you're talking about somebody who's not a victim and someone is an author. I don't think those things really relate, and I really don't know where you're going with all your comments, because I don't think there's something that three people can sit down and talk about in most things in regular society, generally speaking. And I don't know, like you said, somebody came and robbed. I mean, you said, you know, the examples you gave, they honestly sound like storybooks or something, not about real life. If somebody takes something from me that I don't even know them, but they harm my family, how am I supposed to sit down and talk to them and understand where they came from? If I never knew them to begin with, they only took from me and for no reason at all. I guess that's what I want to know about restorative. I just want punishment given.
Thank you for your call, Professor Lyubomsky.
I'm just imagining myself being victimized like that and imagining myself wanting the same thing, which is accountability, which is that somebody harmed me and I want, I'm really wanting, I guess I'm really wanting them to experience the same kind or similar kind of pain that I experienced. And so I resonate with that. And I can, I imagine myself at some point getting to a place where what becomes important to me is not that the person experienced pain, but that the person understands the impact they had on me and understands my pain. And so this is a voluntary process. So the caller who called in, who said, you know, I can't imagine engaging in this restorative process, then he won't. But for people who are who see themselves in the role of a victim, what's the motivation for engaging in a restorative process? The motivation is to let the other person know the impact they had on you. The motivation is to be understood. The motivation is to get something from them that the justice system can't give you, which is regret, some kind of restorative action. You know, I want you to not just give my money back to me. I want you to, what is it that I might want? It's hard because the restorative action is so connected to the symbolic meaning.
To see that I'm
that
a human
has.
Being too.
Yeah.
I have feelings.
Yeah.
I've been reminded that a good deal of this, this approach has come from South Africa with Bishop Desmond Tutu and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission approach, for all of its faults, seems to have inspired a whole lot of people to talk about this, because some of the worst atrocities that I can imagine anywhere in the world in any conflict were committed in South Africa mm-hmm. by white Afrikaners against black folks in places like Soweto. I mean, some of the stories that they confessed in front of their the people that they harmed, as you call them, the authors, were grotesque. And yet Bishop Desmond Tutu says this is the way that you save a society and a community. If you just simply cultivate this approach, you will get yourself in serious troubles such as a civil war down the road. We just have about 35 seconds. Very briefly, is there a website you can tell us about that someone who's interested in doing this can go to?
Yeah, I want to share two websites really quick. One is Dominic Barter's website, which is www.restorativecircles.org. And the other one is about his next training, which is in Atlanta in the United States, which is tinyurl.com/powerwith.
Thank you very much for being with us. It was a very stimulating subject. We've been talking with Professor Mikhail Liobonsky on the topic of restorative justice. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me down.
Thank you.